So I wrapped that piece of silk around this big metal thing that I found. Mm-hmm. And I just wrapped and tied and just had this kind of visceral response to it.
I already had this body of work in mind and in progress. And I looked at the space, and I knew right away what I wanted to do with the space. And then I was luckily chosen to be in the gallery. And so I had about a year to prepare. And I made a few more visits and really developed the work more to fit the space. But I also had more time to think about the content of the work and what I wanted it to look like and feel like.
I'm joined by artist Julia March Crocetto at her exhibition Post-Frontier Landscapes in the R2 Gallery at the Launchpad in Carbondale.
Well, let's take a closer look at your method.
Okay.
So this one in particular,
okay.
I feel like really...
Grand Valley one.
It's amazing the way that it evokes the contours. It's like a topographic map of the Grand Valley.
This is one of the pieces that I started early in working with this idea. So it's one of the first pieces that's specifically about the subject matter. But the techniques are things that I have done previously. The tight, tiny stitching is a method that I developed quite some time back when I would dye cloth and I would respond to the marks of the dye with the stitching. It took me some time to recognize that that stitching had meaning and that my tracing of that topography was purposeful. And so then I put it to use in that specific way of being a topographic line. Just like creating a painting, you have to stand back and get close and stand back and get close as you're making the piece to decide when to stop.
You know, from your artist statement, your work is very much about this difficult place we find ourselves. You use a word, it's not synestalgia.
Solastalgia.
Solastalgia, which is sort of lamenting the loss of a home.
Yes.
While it's
our
occurring.
Collective home in particular. Yes. So yeah, there's that sense of loss or injustice or something that I feel is maybe beyond my control. And I kind of pour it all out in the work.
And you portray a lot of the dry colors of your home in the Grand Mesa Valley. This piece in the center of the room with the sand on the bottom to me evokes a drying river.
Yes, that's the ghost river, the disappearing river. And, you know, in particular the Colorado, but I didn't make it literally of the Colorado, but I think all the rivers are vulnerable here. While I was in process of making this show, just in the last few months, I learned that the Rio Grande is one of the top 10 most endangered rivers in the world. And I had lived in New Mexico along the Rio Grande and had no idea how vulnerable it really was.
In the audience that comes to observe your work, what do you hope they take away?
I let them know I'm having a lament. I don't necessarily expect that they will have a lament, but I hope that it makes them think a little bit. I think the emotional reaction that I'm trying to evoke is more like a sense of wonder and curiosity about the place.
Seems like you play a lot with sort of these unpredictable elements, like a rusty stain.
Yes.
And then you work from a lot of natural pigments.
Yes.
As well.
I specifically seek them out. And this is a discovery I made about myself that I had been doing this for a little while. Partly it started out of curiosity. I wanted to know what those materials did. Therefore, how could I use them best? But when I looked at it as a collaboration, it really opened things up for me. I also was influenced by John Cage and others from Black Mountain College. So John Cage has a famous piece of music that's the 4 minutes and 33 seconds piece, where the majority of the piece is silence, there's no score written. Mm-hmm. And when you see that piece performed, you realize it's not about the silence, it's about all the things that come into the silence in the periphery, whether it's in the room or noises from outside or whatever, and allowing those other elements to become part of the piece and not 100% be in control of it is what I became interested in.
And you mention also in your artist statement that we're living in a time in the West where really there's no place that hasn't been impacted by the colonial legacy that we're living.
And I came to that awareness sort of kicking and screaming. Because I've studied wilderness for a long time. I've lived in national parks and wilderness areas, and I was a park ranger and a guide, and you know, treasure those spaces. But as I learn more about those spaces, and there's a sound biologist, I wish I could remember his name, but he records sound and he travels the world in search of silence. And he has found, I think, that's like 18 minutes is the longest you can go without hearing a human-made sound. And then when you go into those places and you have that kind of experience, you know, out backpacking or something, solo backpacking in Denali is probably the most wilderness experience I've ever had, and there's still a road really close by, and you can always, like, flag somebody down if you need help. It's not... still not that far removed, but the trammeling of the spaces is something that's become politicized and challenging to deal with, whether you are a person who wants to enjoy those spaces or a person who's trying to manage those spaces and trying to keep them as wild as possible. Because when we peel back all of those layers, what we find is that we have removed indigenous peoples from these places. This was their place where they may have gathered or hunted at a specific point in the year. They didn't live and occupy the space, but it was theirs and they used it judiciously. And then we come along and put a border around that that doesn't match up with the ecology of the place. Mm-hmm. Those borders, those transition zones and borders and boundaries are what really fascinate me.
Well, I think we should check in with Kate.
Yes, let's do that.
And then we'll continue on. And we're joined by Kate Talmadge.
The show sort of originated because I have a studio at SAW here in town, and as does Andrew, who is my collaborator on the show. And he came into my studio one day when I was working on my loom, and he was like, "What are you doing?" And I knew that he was interested in sort of computing technology and computer science, and I just sort of offhand said, "Well, I'm coding, Andrew. You know, loom is a binary system. You know, the threads are on or they're off, they're up or they're down." And you could sort of see his wheels turning, like, because, you know, he knew what I was talking about, and I was using a similar language that he was very familiar with. And so that's sort of where the show started. And so there's a timeline on the wall that shows sort of starting, sort of weaving technology and how it sort of progressed through to be used as early computing technology.
Right, and you have like an old card that would be used for weaving, mm-hmm. as well as like an early computation card.
Mm-hmm.
They look so similar.
Yeah, it's basically a way of storing information. Mm-hmm. And then as we sort of developed the idea for the show, Ada Lovelace, who was sort of a savant a little bit, sort of back in the 1800s, she worked with Charles Babbage on early computing machines. And she sort of saw the correlation between these Jacquard punch cards and their ability to store information and how you could use them in other sort of technologies. And so she sort of saw that connection that people would use these in the future. And so she sort of became sort of our muse for the show, and we actually have two pieces in the show named after her. One is Lovelace and the other one is Ada.
Could you talk a little bit about the names of the pieces? They're all
female
names.
Yeah, and so when we, so the first piece we made was, we made for the show, for our proposal, and we called it Lovelace, and so we decided to keep that as a through thread, so we named the rest of the pieces after sort of under-recognized female computer scientists and mathematicians.
Cool.
Yeah.
There's a portion of the show where one piece is directly responding to the other, and then there's other pieces where you've directly painted on top of each other's work.
Mm-hmm. So the show, I'd like to say that in addition to being a collaboration, because the pieces wouldn't exist without each other, it's also a conversational process that Andrew and I had. And so I would weave something and give it to him, and he would paint something in response to it, or he would paint something and give it to me, and then I would weave something in response to that. So it was actually sort of a true dialogue where it wasn't just me giving him woven goods to sort of respond to. We felt like that wasn't necessarily sort of an even balance or an even distribution of the work. And so we sort of just thought that that felt more interesting as well, as so that somebody wasn't always responding to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sort of a true dialogue. But then there are a few pieces that are truly collaborations where, like, I'd given Andrew textiles stretched on stretcher bars, and then he painted on top of them. But there's only a few pieces here and there. Most of the other pieces, most everything else, are true sort of diptychs, two pieces hung together.
And in the center of the gallery is your loom?
One of my
personal
looms.
Loom?
Yeah.
One of them.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're not without a loom.
No. I have two. This one is just obviously easier to transport. My other one is an old early turn of the 20th century loom that's significantly larger and not so easy to fold up and put in the back of my car.
And so is this something you foresee yourself continuing, this incorporating paint into your weaving?
Yeah. It's actually something that I'd done sort of prior to this as well. But when I graduated, because I have my Bachelor of Fine Arts in Fiber and Material Studies, and so, you know, I've been weaving for 15 years, I would say. And for me, I hadn't, well, one, I didn't have space, because you need to have space to have a significantly sized floor loom. They're not sort of small objects. And so I didn't have space, but a lot of my work sort of prior, in the work that I was doing in school, I was painting on the warps when I was weaving things. And it's just been sort of nice to get back into that again. And I see it something particularly in this sort of collaboration with Andrew. We also see this as being sort of an evolving, ongoing project between the two of us, as some sort of touchstone that we can keep coming back to.
Cool.
In our work. So.
And very much just a product of SAW being a shared studio space.
Yeah, yeah. And it, that's one of the beautiful things about that, is that you get exposed to so many people, and just information and ideas coming from all different places, and just the little bits of things that you're like, oh, where did this come from? And then you realize that you saw it in somebody else's work, and it's just sort of become part of your vernacular just through being around it.
So speaking of vernacular, I would like to give both you, Kate, and you, Julia, an opportunity to respond to one another's pieces or comment on how you feel the two shows intersect and complement one another.
I was really excited to learn more about the show when I found out that the Launchpad had curated the two together. They clearly saw the potential for these things to communicate with each other, even though the work didn't really exist yet. I think you guys had made something and had a sample.
Yeah.
And for me, it was the work. I don't even know if I had a specific piece to show them of what I envisioned it to look like. So they took a chance, but they had a vision, and it was really incredible to give us the freedom to fulfill our visions as well. And, you know, textiles naturally have commonality, structure, like you're saying about what you studied as far as the materials themselves.
there's a kind of a common language between them in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And what I really like is how we've kind of shown people how different they can be also.
Yeah, and for me that's the thing too, is that I was sort of like, when they told me that there was going to be another fiber artist in the other gallery, I was sort of like a little bit concerned at first, like, what is it going to be? And then when they told me the work that Julia was going to be doing, I was like, no, that's perfect, because it does. It shows, like you said, it shows the range of what sort of contemporary fiber artists are doing these days. And there's so many different concerns. And on our opening night, we had just talked about the piece that was hanging in the center. And there was this sort of interesting natural segue, because there's sand on the floor, and mm-hmm. sand is silica, and then silica becomes silicone, and then you make computer chips from these sort of metals and earth, and cool. And I use a lot of water when I'm dyeing and painting on my warps, and so there's all these sort of unexpected connections between the work.
Well, they're both contemporary conversations,
mm-hmm.
too.
Yeah, I feel like it's an interesting snapshot of the present moment, where you have technology married with history, and it's next door to sort of the natural environment and the stress that is being experienced in the natural environment today. But both sort of have this history and present element, but from two different but simultaneous worlds, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I also think that there's a lot of both shows have layering. Like,
yes.
There's this very sort of, at their core, they are explorations of process.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So for me, that's sort of another sort of connection that makes the shows not feel, because it'd be really easy to hang two contemporary fiber shows and they'd feel really disparate.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You'd be like, they don't even relate at all. And I think just the fact that our sort of techniques are rooted in process and in materials.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because my work certainly wouldn't exist without my material.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I see the show continues through next Friday, September 6th, first Friday as well. Mm-hmm. Thank you both so much for taking the time to talk with the radio.
Thank you.